What's your life been since January? Has it been eat, sleep, work, repeat? Because you left Twitter early on in January, and then you had all the weirdness of COVID from sort of February onwards. Describe what your life is like now. Do you feel in a weird sort of limbo?
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? I was I was just trying to work out sort of what the new order of things were, and you know, I can't be alone in thinking all the plans that hatched this year are now in ruins. So that's it, really. I was sort of trying to work out what life after Twitter would be, and I had various things sketched out, and they're all gone. But I found a new equilibrium, like I think we've all been forced to, really.
The equilibrium doesn't involve getting up at 4 a.m. for an ice cold bath like your previous boss, though.
I won't hear anything against him. But I was going to be doing some speaking and some events. Actually, I've spent my time researching a book on resilience and identity politics and where those two intersect. So, and it's like, you know, It's sort of captivating research, and it's so tantalizing, the stuff there. So I've spent my time trying to do that, really, just more than anything, so I can emerge from this with some sense that I got anything done.
So you famously got your first job in what was then described as media by doing a cartoon comic strip of your life as a CV. If you were going to draw a few more panes or screens or frames, how would you draw yourself now then?
Yeah, so I drew it. When I was a little kid, when I was growing up, I used to be obsessed with things like the Beano and the Dandy and all those comics. At one stage, I think there were about 7 or 8 comics like that. Whoopi and Whizzer and Chips and all these comics around. And I used to get up every day when I was a little kid about 5:30 and go to the local newsagent when the newsagent opened and buy those comics. Seems like a different world. And so, you know, consequently, when I didn't get a job straight out of college, I drew this cartoon CV. To be fair, I mean, you know, I really padded it out because my life at that stage was pretty uneventful. And to do full 4 pages of cartoon strip on that was probably dragging it out, sort of like one of those novels that could have easily have been 200 pages and it was 800. Actually, you know, the really interesting thing, I'll tell you what that lesson taught me. It taught me that more than anything else, if you can make people buy into you emotionally, they often make decisions that aren't necessarily rationally justified. Because I was applying for dozens of jobs. I was trying to get a job in record companies. I was trying to get a job in lawyers' firms. I tried to apply for law. And I was getting sort of no responses. And then I did this cartoon CV, and I was getting people coming back from long liquid lunches, phoning me, regaling me with how much they loved it. They people sort of inviting me in for work experience. So, you know, I always say I quite often go and do speakers for schools when society permits it. And one of the things that I always say to the kids there is don't underestimate. If you can get someone's attention, actually you can make things happen. And, you know, most people these days receive 0 letters in the post. So if you can send something to them that's like this tantalizing, beguiling thing, then don't bet against it.
One of the quotes that I read during the course of thinking about this was the one that was quoted in the Financial Times, that Twitter is too important to be left to Twitter. And I could see what that meant, because it has become the most extraordinarily important thing, hasn't it, over the last decade? I mean, were you aware of that when you went in, and the enormity of the job, and indeed the responsibility that you had, you know, looking after it here in Europe?
Yeah, when I first joined Twitter, I joined Twitter. There was about 300 employees. It was just starting to develop a business model. Dick Costolo was the CEO, and it was famed at the time for being sort of the chat room for Jonathan Ross and Stephen Fry and Simon Pegg, and, you know, or sort of it was a quirky comedic place. And I was just really enchanted with it. I absolutely adored it. It was just starting to have an impact in politics. It was just starting to sort of be considered as something that was going to be, I remember a story at the time in 2012 where John Prescott, who was, was no longer deputy leader of the Labour Party. And so, but, you know, had been, had had something written about him in the newspapers, and he tweeted out about it, and he got a retraction within 2 or 3 hours. And he said at the time, you know, this is extraordinary. Normally we would spend days chasing them with lawyers' letters and we'd eventually get a retraction. And to get a retraction this quickly means that this story won't have a day two, it won't run. And he said, you know, this is a fundamental realignment of how politics and how people can get a voice. So I think we all, when we worked there, we all felt like cheerleaders for what it represented. For me, you know, those things go on. So, you know, I'm especially focused with my sort of own energies on climate change. And I think, you know, the reason why Greta Thunberg won Time Person of the Year last year, but also the reason why she's sort of known in households across the planet, is because social media has given this sort of brilliant individual a platform. Because I suspect you play it back 10, 15 years and you've got a 15, 16-year-old sitting outside her local parliament doing a school strike, it might get in the national news after a year of her doing it. It might get in the international news if that gets picked up. But the idea that, you know, she would build this movement that's brought millions of people to the streets, I think is entirely powered by social media. So, you know, I think there was a sense back early days, I mean, like from the very start of Twitter, people felt that the weird combination of something being so reductive, so simplistic, you know, the 140 characters at the time seemed to sort of create this fusion of things that had a powerful impact. But so we were all cheerleaders for it. But I think it's interesting that it remains really as strong now as it was then.
It's interesting, isn't it, that the disruptive change that's been brought about by tech or big tech over the last decade. In the last couple of years, there's been much more of an accent on the kind of, you know, the negative, and there's been talk about the need for kind of further regulation and all the rest of it. I mean, to what extent did you feel the kind of responsibility of being at the head of something that was such a sort of a powerful instrument?
Yeah, I think, you know, critically, when you're doing a job like that, when you're involved in an organization like that, the focus is very intently that you want to ensure that you're acting as a good advocate for the people who use the product. You're making sure that the voice of your country is being, and your region is being represented. Because, you know, if you were working for a French company, then you'd want to ensure that the views of, you know, the UK, the US were represented, Africa were represented. And so, you know, it's really important that you take a job like that almost specifically to give voice to maybe the people who wouldn't naturally be heard otherwise. So, yeah, absolutely. It's taken immensely seriously, you know. And the considerations, the issues, the debates about regulation, about those things, it's really important, I think, that you play yourself in a role there where you're not simply a cheerleader. You're not simply sort of taking the lines to take. You're not, you know, you've got to clearly represent the company externally, but also when it comes to how you're trying to ensure that you give voice to arguments internally, it's really critical that you're sort of, you're almost hostile on the inside and friendly on the outside. You've got to ensure that, you know, and there's a couple of British board members of the Twitter board, and, you know,
was a board member, wasn't she?
Sorry. Yeah. And, you know, regular sort of dialogues to ensure really that, you know, we are giving good account of a diversity, a plurality of opinions, really.
Now, one of the interesting things that you have talked about is the difference between European and US attitudes towards freedom of speech and libertarianism. And we can see that now, can't we, that the sort of purity argument seems to be more in favour over the other side of the Atlantic than it is here. And within the EU, you clearly have individuals now who are going to try and do something to curtail that freedom of speech. And so where did you find yourself in that argument, sort of representing, you know, the European mindset to your, you know, your American colleagues and board members?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, there's an old truism, beware simple answers to difficult questions. And the challenge that we always had is that it's very easy for anyone to step into a debate and say, you need to do something about this. And, you know, the challenge that I always used to say in return was, can you tell me specifically what you want to happen? Because, you know, to give you an illustration, people might say, I wish the quality of discourse would be better. I wish, you know, I used to work at YouTube. So let's talk specifically about YouTube, because for a long time, it was regarded that YouTube was the home of the worst comments on the internet. You know, a video used to be posted and there used to be horrible slurs and horrible name calling within 30 seconds of any video being posted. And so, you know, people used to say, well, you need to improve this. And I'd say, okay, great. I wholly agree with you, but can you tell me specifically how you think it should be improved? And the challenge is that normally then what happens is the rhetoric of politics, people step into it and they say, well, you need to solve that. You need to tell us. And the challenge, of course, is that as soon as you start trying to work out what it is, you bring value judgments to the situation. Mm-hmm. And my concern is that when you meet the politicians who are making these decisions, and I think anyone who's watching the way that politicians are handling the coronavirus epidemic, is that any politicians who... Well, certainly, I think we're witnessing incompetence on a sort of vast scale. And, you know, that same degree of incompetence brought to social media has massively unexpected consequences. So, you know, people say, well, you need to do this, you need to do this, you need to do this. And you tell them, okay, but this is the consequence. So let me give you one of the obvious examples. People would routinely say, oh, I don't see why there should be anonymous accounts on the internet. One of the simplest and longest running debates, and Twitter's what, sort of 13, 14 years old. And, you know, it's been ongoing because that was one of these disagreements. If you could look at, you know, the principal differences between, say, Twitter and Facebook, Facebook was real identities. Facebook, you could post as much as you wanted. Facebook was algorithm driven. Twitter was a reverse chrono. So, you know, it was like, it was just live. It was 140 characters. It was, and you could have, you could post under a pseudonym. But the consequences of that is that, you know, so aside from things like the Arab Spring, which the anonymity actually fueled this tool to be an incredible catalyst to something that was taking place. But, you know, you look at sites like Mumsnet. Mumsnet have an anonymity policy. You're allowed to post under a pseudonym. And it allows a full exploration of postnatal depression. It allows people to talk about issues about, you know, lack of attachment with their children. It allows them to talk about challenges with their partner. It facilitates a candor of dialogue that, you know, sometimes when we're wearing an avatar that's projecting a positive image of ourselves, we're not able to access that degree of candor in our conversation. You know, one of the wonderful quotations from Gia Tolentino's wonderful Trick Mirror is she talks about how, you know, Facebook taught us that an important function in life is to maintain a positive social avatar. You know, like our job is to create this digital projection of ourselves that we then maintain. And, you know, anonymity affords you the opportunity to step outside the artifice of that creation and allows you to maybe have a sort of a more complex, a more nuanced discussion. Mm. So I think, you know, that's the challenge. A politician steps in and it's very easy if you're playing to the cheap seats to say, well, we need to get rid of anonymity. But it's so much more complex than that. Yeah. And, you know, of course, if you are incredibly reductive to it. Of course, simple answers look like they win the debate. And it'd win a question time argument. If we were sitting around the table on question time now, someone said, well, you know, the only reason you need anonymity is it's a home for trolls. And the audience would clap. And, you know, no, there's so much more sophistication to the argument than that. And that's the challenge when it comes to regulation. I think all of the social platforms have talked about, you know, they welcome regulation. The concern is, if you remember sort of Mark Zuckerberg's testimony to first the House committee last year and then the Senate committee the next day. And, you know, we witnessed, I don't know if you remember this, but we witnessed before our eyes the flaws of lay people creating policy because it was, there was such a lack of precision. There was such a lack of understanding of the nuance. Now, you know, if someone said to you now, I want you to regulate elections, well, there'd probably be a very easy, quick tick list that you or I could write. But if you're going to get into like a sophisticated way to avoid it being subverted, then you need experts. And that's the challenge, that when you've got lay people creating policies for headlines, you miss the complexity that inherently runs through the need to police these sort of platforms, really.
I mean, if you'd been in charge of Facebook, would you have banned David Icke, for example?
Yeah, the really interesting thing about... it's difficult, isn't it? Because by banning people, you add fuel to the suggestion that... What Twitter did, Twitter sort of, yeah, I mean, I don't know the specifics of what Twitter did on that one because I'd left. But, you know, it's really difficult. I think, you know, let's talk about the YouTube platform. The YouTube platform is interesting. One of the debates we had when I first worked at YouTube, I worked there just for 4 years immediately after Google had bought it. And, you know, it's fascinating for me, like as an idiot from a council estate in Birmingham, to be in a room where, you know, I was sitting in San Bruno in sort of California, sitting in a room as we were debating the ethics and the policy of how to deal with this brand new phenomenon that was just taking shape, that was mass shootings, where the perpetrator of it had posted a video online. So this was a new thing, and Breivik, the sort of the guy who did it in Norway, he posted a video online, but it was happening all the time. And the challenge they had was this, is that, you know, the channels that these people had put up there, they would immediately, an incident happened, they would go searching YouTube, they would find it. They all had channels, you know, it was this extraordinary phenomenon where they all had created, like there was a series of mass shootings where each one of them had created a YouTube channel and put videos up there. And so, you know, the team would go and start searching and take it down. However, if someone else had got to the channel first, had downloaded, had ripped all the videos and then re-uploaded them, YouTube would leave the videos up there. And, you know, the debate was really clearly what they were doing. They were taking the videos down as they existed in the original form because they were hate speech, but they were allowing them to stay up there if someone else had got there and was reporting on them, because that's reportage. Right. And I think, you know, in that, you can see the complexity of this situation, because what they didn't want to do is be responsible for propagating this, but also what they didn't want to be responsible for was editing the internet and sort of denying, you know, I guess by taking it down, it would be suggesting, you know, YouTube had nothing to do with this, the platform didn't host this. And look, you know, for me as a sort of simple-minded fool in a room with lawyers debating the ethics of this, it was so fascinating to witness that, okay, gosh, this is of a level of complexity that is beyond what superficially you might imagine. And the challenge is this, is that, you know, there's one extreme that you can go to. Okay, you say, okay, ban everything. It's almost like denying that progress is happening, that technology is advancing, that, you know, we want to sort of go to a situation where we're burying our head in the sands and hoping these things didn't happen. And of course, it's not a sensible way for anyone to proceed. And so, you know, you have to sit there going, okay, the world is changing. We need to recognize that if these things aren't on our platform, they will be on somewhere else. And so let's try and create order in the way we're doing it. Now, look, you know, subsequently, I do think that the way that the YouTube algorithm has optimized to try and get people to view has meant, you know, and I searched this, and they've definitely changed this in the last 3 months, because I sort of search it occasionally. But there was a long time when you would search Holocaust. It's definitely changed now. I remember searching about 3 weeks ago. If you search Holocaust on YouTube, the whole first page was videos why the Holocaust was a hoax.
Yeah.
Now that is, it's so dangerously toxic, because, you know, if you've got school children searching why the Holocaust is a hoax, or searching the Holocaust for a school project, and then they're immediately assailed with that, then the question of what is true and false is becomes sort of a really important thing. And a lot of us right now are witnessing, I saw someone, an ex-colleague of mine, tweeting about yesterday, a lot of us are witnessing, you know, this happening before our very eyes with the 5G debate. Mm-hmm. Or with the David Icke debate, which is sort of adjacent to it, people going out and propagating truth. I had a conversation on a Zoom drink with some friends the other day, and a friend said, oh, yeah, I would definitely not take a vaccine. Vaccines are really dangerous. It's like, what? Where is this, like, alternative reality coming from? Where is this parallel universe coming from where people are sort of making up their own versions of facts? And, you know, look, so I really strongly empathize with the difficulty of making these decisions, because, you know, it becomes the Streisand effect, right? The Streisand effect, you'll be familiar with the Streisand effect. The Streisand effect is that Barbara Streisand has a beautiful house in Beverly Hills, and a photograph of her beautiful house, really just commenting that it was a beautiful house, appeared in a book of photography, and she went to the court to ban the book and to get the book removed and stop the book being published. And the end consequence of that was that this photographic book that probably would have had a circulation of 3,000 or 4,000 coffee table copies, the photograph of her house became worldwide news. And so the Streisand effect is, you know, you might set out to keep something out of the news, and the very act that you do that makes it big news. But there's the Streisand effect on this. You know, David Icke is sort of, must have very low name recognition, aside from people obsessed with politics and news. But immediately you ban him, and then the narrative becomes, yeah, the system is trying to silence him. And, you know, it's a no win, but I do strongly empathize that it's probably the right thing to do.
But isn't the trouble with Icke that, you know, right back to sort of villages in the Middle Ages, you've always had the village idiot, haven't you? And people kind of knew who the village idiot was, and that he was a bit odd and kind of came up with these strange sort of concepts and theories about things. And he was sort of regarded as such. And what worries me about things like that, and I know it sounds a bit sort of patronizingly kind of, you know, middle class, you know, ABC one of me, is that surely you've got to allow people to sort of, you know, to discriminate and work out for themselves where, you know, where they're going to find their truths. And yeah, that is, as a, you know, the libertarian in me, it kind of worries me that the curation of the, you know, the chattering classes and the great and the good is, you know, can have deleterious effects.
Okay, so let's test your theory. So one of the things, so Sandy Hook, you'll be familiar with Sandy yep. Hook massacre. So there are a lot of people who tried to claim that Sandy Hook was a wholly staged event to try and turn the narrative against guns. So talk me through your philosophy of what we should do about those people who go out and talk about Sandy Hook being a hoax.
The simple answer, Bruce, is I don't know, but I do know that what worries me is that the leaden hand of regulation can end up going in the wrong sort of direction and actually taking some of the important, not only vitality out of it, but actually kind of, you know, those those senses of people who don't have sort of voices and do feel it's quite important for them to be able to get up there and say something in the same way as you said they do on Mumsnet or wherever. I don't know what the answer to it is, but I think at the moment it feels to me as if the regulators, I mean, you know, Zuckerberg is almost sort of saying, you know, come on, please regulate us. You know, we know we've got a problem. We want to sort of, you know, get big government to help us sort it out. And I can see how that could end up having lots of unintended consequences. Don't you think that?
Yeah, absolutely. But I do worry in the flaw in your argument. So, you know, look, so let's look at the situation there with Sandy Hook. So Alex Jones, the InfoWars host, was perpetrating this narrative that Sandy Hook was faked. It was using child actors. If you'll remember Sandy Hook, it was the slaughter of really sort of kindergarten age kids. It was it was a horrific killing. The toll of it on the parents of the people involved has been relentless, because the assertion by Alex Jones that it was fake and it was all hoax has meant that the people whose children were killed have then endured 5-10 years of abuse from sort of alt-right and right-wing trolls, but also the people who sort of watch that content that probably wouldn't necessarily describe themselves as weaponized into that community. And they've endured not only the grief, but they've endured the enduring consequence of the hype around it. Now, Alex Jones was in court. He was recently ordered to pay $100,000 damages. Mm-hmm. He was in court and he admitted that it was all entertainment. He was, you know, he was peddling this story as part of his act. And so, you know, the question then becomes, here's the big thing. If you've got platforms that are being deliberately subverted by people who are seeking to create, you know, toxic performance art from them, then it's unfortunately, I think probably so often in life, we err on the side of optimism and sort of thinking benign thoughts about things. But, you know, you can't help but think to my mind, I can't help but think there's something wrong when the burden of that going wrong is borne by the victims rather than by the person propagating what they've admitted in court is lies.
But where do you think this is going to end up then? Because clearly, you know, things are on the move there, both in Washington and in Brussels. How do you see it moving forward? Because clearly one of the issues is going to be, you know, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, these are global entities. And if you're going to end up taking different steps in different countries, that's going to create a kind of a complexity there, which will be awkward as well. I mean, where do you see it panning out over the next few years when it comes to regulation?
Yeah, I mean, that already exists, to be fair. There's things that you can't do in Germany that you can do elsewhere. You can't insult the king of Indonesia in Indonesia, but you can do it elsewhere. So those things already exist. Clearly, you know, it's easier for everyone if you've got a level playing field and the sort of, you know, it's easier if it's consistent everywhere, but it's not impossible, especially when you're running platforms of scale, to have different rules in different countries.
What about the thing that always interested me was the accusation, particularly in the States, that Twitter had a left-wing algorithmic bias. What did you used to make of that when people said that?
Of all the platforms I've worked in, there's an obsession with being level and... Look, here's one of the challenges that we're walking into now, that to some extent, one of the challenges we're walking into now, that to some extent, knowing how people vote for the first time in history determines their take on politics, their take on historical events. You know, so the first time, let's look at US politics. For the first time in history, we know that the way that people are registered to vote has a bearing on whether they believe the evidence of coronavirus, whether they believe the evidence of global warming, the sort of climate crisis. And, you know, that's one of the challenges. But let me tell you, you know, the people that I've worked with in every technology company have been of the utmost integrity. So, you know, the question then becomes, should you try to, should YouTube, let's look at YouTube again, should YouTube try to downweight things in the algorithm that say that 5G is causing coronavirus? Well, it's factually not true. And you might have people stepping into that saying, well, that's bias. That's left-wing bias. Mm-hmm. Well, look, it's biasing to the facts. If we're truly going to be here to decide our own facts, it's a dangerous place to be, I think.
Mm. So, look, you trained as an economist, and you've become an expert on the workplace now. You've written two books about it. How do you see the future of business life, and specifically the life of those people who traditionally have worked together in offices or factories post-COVID? I mean, do you think it's too early to tell, or do you think there are already signs of what it's going to be like in a year or two's time?
To my mind, you know, if I was running the UK economy right now, I'd be thinking, okay, there's a massive opportunity afforded. Brexit's a done deal. There's a massive opportunity afforded to us. There's a lot of tech jobs based in Dublin, and everyone's sort of baffled how that was ever consistent with the way that the EU worked. But there's a lot of tech jobs in Dublin, and I'd be thinking, what is the quickest way to get all of those jobs into the United Kingdom and sort of incentivize them? And, you know, the critical thing I think that we're witnessing right now is that if we could distribute, as the world is right now debating whether the norms of work are a long-term shift into remote working, I'd be thinking, right, what's the best way to bring a lot of those jobs to Yorkshire? What's the best way to bring a lot of those jobs to Northumberland? And you know, trying to incentivize those things. I think, you know, broadly where we are is that probably best way I can characterize it, I chatted to a friend of mine who works at a big major news outlet, and he said, we've got a London office that has 1,400 people coming into it every day. He said, in the last 8 weeks, we've had 30 people come in and the product hasn't changed one bit. He said, anyone who tells you that the world is going to go back to the way it was is kidding themselves. And as we've witnessed, anyone who does follow news media will know that, you know, successively over the last few days, the BuzzFeed, The Atlantic, all manner of sort of publications day by day are making job cuts, redundancies. And, you know, that's the only reason why sort of news is front of mind is because it's high interest. But, you know, for news, read the packaged good business, you know, the whole of packaged goods, anyone who makes chocolate or things like that have been working for the last few years on something called zero-based budgeting. And what that means is that activist investors have been running around all of the businesses. And if they've got a wanton take on allowing copies being made at work or printers or travel, then activist investors have been insisting that they cut all the costs. So, you know, you find yourself working at Nestle up in York now, and very soon someone's going to be saying to you, well, we can get all the office workers to work from home and we're going to save. The average rule of thumb is that, you know, the costs of a business are 90% wages, 9% rent, 1% electricity and bills. And so, you know, someone's going to be sitting there going, okay, well, we could save 7, 8, 9% of our costs by getting everyone to work from home. And the idea that that won't happen, I think, is once again where optimism might triumph over experience, because, you know, almost certainly any business going into the next 2 years is going to be faced with probably the biggest depression that any of us will witness in our lifetimes. And so every business is going to be sitting there thinking, right, we're in a hand-to-mouth existence. How can we make sure that we get out of this? We sort of survive and we keep the business going. So I think, you know, broadly, we're going to be in a situation where remote working becomes a norm. And maybe that's remote working with a twist, where you come into the office when these client interactions, or you come into the office for big team meetings, and so, you know, that your office looks different. It becomes sort of almost like a showroom, almost like the Apple Store, what the Apple Store has done for retail. You know, we've got big showy space that probably is just for sort of big interactions. And then we find that, you know, the rest of work is done at home. And I think that's almost inevitable. The question then becomes, you know, a lot of a lot of firms have been outsourcing some of their back office to places like Hyderabad in India and have been outsourcing it. And, you know, the act becomes, how do you demonstrate the value of keeping it onshore here? How do you incentivize that? Because otherwise, you know, it's pretty evident that this situation has been a massive wave of disruption, probably unmatched in our lifetime. And, you know, I think we need to move quickly to build the new reality before it's built for us.
Don't you think one of the other interesting things that's happened during the last 3 months when it comes to big tech is that the whole AI surveillance debate has been sort of reignited, but unexpectedly in a positive way? Because in South Korea, they famously using what are effectively surveillance methods to reduce the spread of the virus. And you can see how the sort of people who've been kind of anxious about that in China are suddenly on the back foot with that argument, aren't they? Because it seems to be a method by which tech can actually be used unquestionably for good, you know, to keep people healthy and alive. So how have you been observing that? What are your thoughts on that subject? Yeah,
well, and you can see in UAE. So in UAE in Dubai, they banned WhatsApp, but a new app appeared in the App Store that offered all the functionality of WhatsApp, and eventually Google banned it. I think it might be sort of back in some sort of state of limbo. Apple and Google banned it because it appeared to be run by the UAE government, so they could read everyone's messages. So, you know, definitely we're sort of witnessing governments around the world getting their act together on these things more completely, I think.
What do you feel about sort of China and facial recognition technology? Because it's been interesting there. I mean, I think I'm right in saying that it's actually illegal to use in San Francisco, isn't it? Whereas clearly the Chinese, because they have a view of the perfectibility of society through means of control, are wholeheartedly in favor of it.
There was an incredible article, I think, in the New York Times about a month ago of an app that the US police, or there's no such thing as the US police, but police in various states were using, that effectively had built a reverse search engine for of all the images on the web. And so the story that they describe is a guy was out in a restaurant. He saw his daughter on a date. He took a photograph of the guy. He did a reverse search, and it came up that the guy was a trainee lawyer. And this is an app. This is a technology that is already being used in a lot of US police forces. Blimey, mind blowing. So, you know, so while there are some states not using these things, it's going to be a reality. I went to China about 18 months ago on a very agreeable holiday, I have to tell you. I couldn't recommend it more as a holiday. And you witness facial technology, facial recognition technology everywhere. And I'm certain that one of the things about our phones has been the utility becomes so captivating that we end up sort of overlooking the privacy implications. But I can certainly imagine that, you know, if people are just walking up to bank machines, taking money out and not having to do any admin, then over time, the old analog technology of putting a card in and pressing numbers will feel sort of dusty and ridiculous. And I think, you know, that's somehow how we've allowed some of this technology into our lives, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I think, you know, the old thing that's I just think, you know, we've found ourselves sort of agreeing to go along with things because the upside, the superficial upside, seems so benign.
But do you know Franklin Foer's book World Without Mind that kind of predated Shoshana Zuboff's book? Let me quote you something from that, and let's get your reaction to it. He said, it was actually in the introduction to it, more than any previous coterie of corporations, the tech monopolies aspire to mold humanity into their desired image of it. They believe that they have the opportunity to complete the long merger between man and machine to redirect the trajectory of human evolution. Do you think, A, that that is true? And B, do you think that that is the aim of of big tech companies.
I mean, look, you know, I broadly agree with New York Stern professor Scott Galloway, who believes that we probably should break up the big firms, mm-hmm. because simply because it's sort of in service. If YouTube was separate to Google, if Facebook was separate to Instagram, it's in service of more innovation. It's more sort of, it's better for everyone. It's actually even better for their shareholders. So, you know, I broadly agree that those things are true. Look, you know, the challenge becomes, I think, when these companies become so big, they start believing that they're trying to create a vision of what the future looks like. And so, you know, you've got some of the fanciful projects that Google has done. I mean, Google's made all its money out of search and a tiny, tiny, tiny bit of money out of other advertising. And yet, you know, they've been talking. I started at Google 12 years ago. 13 years ago, and they were talking about self-driving cars there. I mean, mamma mia, sort of talk about a slow production cycle, you know, because it's just too big. There's just no imperative. They make so much money from other stuff. So look, you know, personally, I think probably the whole of society and their shareholders would be benefited from those companies being more focused and a little bit smaller.
Isn't one of the good things about Twitter, and you probably can tell I'm a fan, is that it's about look at that, not look at me. And that's why I think always that, you know, one felt favorably towards it, that it was not about kind of narcissism. It was about dialogue and ideas and punting things around. Whereas I think Facebook and particularly Instagram, you know, looking at the effects of it on even my 10-year-old daughter, who made the mistake during lockdown of inviting her teacher to like her Instagram page, she got a letter from the headmistress. I mean, do you feel optimistic about Twitter's long-term future for those reasons, that it is actually a kind of important part of what, you know, ultimately the democratic process?
I mean, look, I'm an enormous fan of it. I absolutely adore using it. And that was why I was delighted to go and work there and why I still use it all day now. You're exactly right. I think we've learned, though, that different apps serve different functions. And, you know, specifically, most of us spend the majority of our time in five apps. And when you press that icon, you know specifically what you want to get. And so, you know, with WhatsApp, you know, it's messaging. With Instagram, you just want escapist glossy photographs. With Twitter, it's normally connecting with news of some sort, and that might be news about your football team, or it might be news about the societal collapse we're witnessing. And, you know, but it's one thing, it's, you know why you're opening the app. And I think my personal feeling, I do subscribe to the sort of philosophy that comparison leads to unhappiness. And so, you know, I quite enjoy Instagram, but I only follow like architecture things and graffiti things and a few musicians. I don't follow anyone's life because it drives me absolutely crazy to see a sort of deeply manicured photograph of someone's day out in the park. I find it exhausting. So, you know, we all sort of curate our own experience, but I do subscribe to the philosophy that comparison leads to unhappiness.
Okay, then your final one. What was the best thing about leading Twitter in Europe, and what aspects of it consistently caused you the most worry, anxiety, and that you were the leader of something, and, you know, what aspect of it you know, you used to wake up in the morning worrying about?
You know, I love new things. I love innovation. I love, you know, I'm sort of, you know, I love watching how things evolve. If anyone doesn't use TikTok, or maybe if they want to look over the shoulder of their kids or nephews or nieces, TikTok is just like an extraordinary explosion of creativity right now. It's back to what Vine was sort of 7 or 8 years ago. And so, you know, I love watching new things take form and you see new talent emerge from it. I love it. For me, I always saw the honor of my job, and I felt immensely lucky to have that job. The honor of my job was making sure I represented the people who used the platform. So, you know, quite often if there was someone in the news who'd been contacted or who'd been in the press and they'd had a bad experience, so, you know, I would contact them and quite often, you know, take the heat of their anger, but to try and, more than anything, empathize with them and represent them in the dialogue internally. And so that meant, you know, I would routinely reach out to people who were angry, upset, annoyed, because I felt like if I could humanize the experience and I could make them demonstrate to them that, you know, that people were trying to get things resolved in a good way, then at the very least, you know, when I next sat down with senior leadership, I could represent their views. And look, you know, let me tell you, that can make you deeply unpopular in a company, because, you know, if you're always telling people, you know, if you're candidly discussing where things have gone wrong, you know, it doesn't make for an easy, harmonious, you know, it's like turning up at the Christmas dinner and telling everyone how dad messed up the drive. It's sort of, you know, it doesn't make for harmony, but I saw it as an important part. If I'd been so fortunate to get this job, it was an important part of me trying to live up for it. And, you know, like you get no shortage of people criticizing you on Twitter and haranguing you, and it was all part of it. It was all like, okay, yeah, okay, you know, people would say, what do you know, you idiot, what do you, and like, it's all part of trying to ensure that we were creating something that was a good experience in Germany, France, Britain, everywhere really.
And what do you want to do now? Do you want to do a book? I mean, are you going to take the conventional route of non-execs and things like that, or do you dare think 3, 4, 5 years ahead about what's next?
I'm trying to do some climate stuff. I'm trying to help a couple of organizations raise some money for climate activism. Like I say, I'm writing this book on resilience. If anyone wants to subscribe to my newsletter, if you go to eatsleepworkrepeat.com, I do an update on sort of how the world of work is changing, but I'm writing this book on resilience. That's my main focus, really. I mean, look, you know, I was actually sort of hunkered down writing this book on identity and identity politics, resilience, and then sort of the whole of work combusted. And I thought, right, okay, I need to sort of focus some of my attention on that. So, you know, that's what I want to try and do. I haven't necessarily got a firm plan. So, you know, maybe long term, I'll create a company or something.
But anybody with any firm plans at the moment is going to see them change by the end of next month. Bruce, thank you very much.